welcome back to the Slightly Fox podcast, brought to you again from North London, Dartmoor and Cambridge. Here in Cambridge, I'm Philippa Lamb, and joining me remotely from Highbury in North London, I have Slightly Fox editor Hazel Wood. Hello, Hazel.
Hello.
And in Devon, Hazel's partner in publishing, Gail Perkis.
Good morning.
How's it all going, you two?
It's going remarkably well. We've been incredibly fortunate through lockdown and the easing of lockdown because our system seemed to work.
You've had a lot of book orders, I believe.
We have. People are reading, which is wonderful.
And I think also our subscribers are very, very supportive, aren't they? They've really pulled out the stops to help us out.
Yes, they have. They've been brilliant.
Make extra orders, give gift subscriptions. It's really been terribly cheering.
And lots of messages, because I've seen quite a lot of messages about the podcast, but presumably about lots of other Foxed things as well.
Yes, Jess in the office does a digest for us once a week. And it's, you know, it's a long list and you get to know these people. I mean, there really is a personal connection. Very touching.
It is really delightful, isn't it, that people all over the world, because you've got a big audience in Australia now.
Yes. You know, we've even got somebody in Mauritius. She's actually a botanist. She's been to see us when she came over to England, and we had to hold her order because no post was going to Mauritius, but I'm glad to say that's now lifted.
Yeah, it's the wonders of podcasting as well. Well, of course, print initially, but podcasting now. And since, actually, I should say, we're all comfortably ensconced in our homes yet again, any or indeed all of us might be interrupted. Postmen, couriers, a host of other more rural surprises in Gail's case. So please bear with us. On to today's discussion, which is a timely one, as small businesses of every sort have been grappling with the many challenges of staying afloat right now. There has been a lot in the media about how tough life has been for indie bookshops. And of course, book publishers have had their troubles too. So we thought it would be interesting to hear a first-hand account of that from a publisher with a very clear-eyed view of the world we're now living in, John Woolcott of Little Toller Books, one of the few English publishers not based in London. Now, before I introduce John, let me just tell you that the reading from the Slightly Foxed archive this month is about John Seymour's The Fat of the Land. We'll have reading recommendations from everyone towards the end. But now it's a great pleasure to introduce John Woolcott from Little Toller Books in Dorset. Hello, John.
Hello, how are you?
Well, we're good, thank you. It's delightful to have you with us. Tell us a bit about Little Toller.
So, yes, we've been around for 10 years, and we started by publishing these wonderful, great classics of rural writing in a series that we call our Nature Classics. And we started by publishing three of them at the same time, which was Four Hedges by Claire Leighton, Adrian Bell's book Men in the Fields, and The South Country by Edward Thomas. And in each case, we thought, well, we need to introduce these great classics to a new audience. So we invited contemporary writers to write the introductions to those books, and we put some beautiful covers on them. And then within the pages, we tried our best to maintain the feel of those early editions by incorporating illustrations and things like that. So it's been a tremendously exciting, long, sometimes arduous journey over the last 10 years.
And you've spread your wings a bit, haven't you, from those early, very rural roots into slightly different
areas? Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, I think for the first 4 or 5 years, we really only did publish those classics.
I mean, obviously, as a publisher, you need an identity. How do you know when a book is for Little Toller?
We talk about this all the time. It's a really interesting question. I think Adrian and Gracie, who started Little Toller 10 years ago, had a very strong idea of what they wanted to achieve, starting with the classics, but then branching out. And I think they wanted to, first of all, think about rural writing and nature, but also more broadly about place and where humans fit into landscape. And I think we've also thought we wanted to slightly trample over those established kind of boundaries that new nature writing sometimes has, which can be a little bit like somebody walks into a field, looks at a butterfly, admires the butterfly, feels slightly sad about the butterfly. And actually, we thought, well, maybe we should do something else about that and celebrate some of the, maybe edgy isn't quite the right word, but to try to find different voices, I suppose. And so actually in the classic series, one of the books we publish is The Unofficial Countryside by Richard Mabey, which is all about how you can find nature in cities and in, you know, places that look a little bit scrappy. And that's really important to understand that, you know, ecology and nature can thrive in unusual places.
You're very clever with your illustrations, I've noticed. You've got the original John Nash illustrations to the Men in the Fields.
Yes, we do.
And also Edward Thomas, those photographs in Pursuit of Spring.
That was lucky, actually. one of the benefits, I suppose, of the digital world is that these things can come to your attention a little bit easier. I mean, we'd spotted a photographer writing about these photographs, and they weren't really known about. They were hidden away in the Thomas Archive in Cardiff. And for a long time, I think the archive had wanted to make them better known. So when we decided to reissue In Pursuit of Spring, we decided to incorporate some of Edward Thomas's photographs, and it makes the book somehow a lot richer than it would have been otherwise. It's a wonderful book. It's really a book about him becoming a poet in a way. So there are some which we still don't know. We don't know where some of those photos are that are in the book. So we do ask readers, if they know where some of those pictures are, let us know and we'll incorporate them into the next edition.
Yes, they're so atmospheric, beautiful. Mm-hmm. And what's your own background, John? You were in bookselling.
Oh, yeah. I've been working in books for more than 30 years. My first job was working in an Australian bookshop when I was travelling, where, believe it or not, we sold books by weight because it was a good gimmick. And you can either buy them at $2 a kilo, and that had a sort of blue sticker on it, or $3 a kilo, or $4 a kilo, depending on how important or beautiful the book was. But it was a great experience. I came back to England, wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, ended up working in a branch of Waterstones. Then I spent most of the rest of the next few years working in the kind of retail side of it, either in shops or in head offices, before leaving that London life about 5 or 6 years ago.
And have you always had this sort of passion for romantic ruins? Because you wrote a lovely piece for us.
Well, thank you for saying so. Yes, I have. I can't explain it, and I don't know where that passion for romantic ruins comes from. And I know that not many people share that obsession, but I'm pleased to say that after you published my piece in Slightly Fox, quite a lot of people have got in touch saying they enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great.
Tell us a bit about the last few months and how it's been for you.
Oh, that's an excellent question, because it's been an exciting ride, actually. It did look awful in that bookshops were closed, and of course they are the way that most of our books get distributed. But in fact, we found that our website has been enormously popular. Readers have really responded to us, and we've, like you, had lots of new subscriptions, lots and lots of orders. But the most important thing was that we had one book which is basically our first ever bona fide bestseller, which is Dara McAnulty's book, Diary of a Young Naturalist.
Yes, it was a BBC, BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week, wasn't it?
It was, yes. And in a way, that Book of the Week slot forced us to continue to publish the book at that point, because I think what people have responded to in these difficult times is this young, hopeful, eloquent voice. He's really hit a nerve. So actually, Dara's book and Dara himself has been a huge, hugely important thing for Little Toller. And I think it probably marks a little bit about the way we want to develop the list, really, and that we're interested in finding different and unusual voices who can say something really pertinent.
It's interesting you say about knowing that you were going to get that Radio 4 slot. How far in advance did you know that?
We worked we've been working on this book for quite a long time with Dara. So I think we probably knew 6 months ago. That's quite unusual. Okay. You don't usually have that sort of notice.
As you say, you might have pulled it otherwise. And a lot of publishers have been pulling books, haven't they?
I'm not sure whether we would have pulled it or not, because we had lots of other things alongside it as well. And actually, the moment that people like the Hay Festival said, well, we think we can do this online. And so Dara did the first ever event for Hay Festival online this year. Then we realised that actually this book has its own momentum. And Dara is such an important, passionate voice that it just made sense to continue to publish it. So it might have seemed like a rash decision, but in retrospect, it was the right one, I'm pleased to say.
Well, tell us what makes it such a special book.
It's his voice. I mean, he's 16 years old now. He wrote most of the book when he was 14. It's divided into four sections for each season. And it's really about his connection to the natural world, both as a young person and also somebody who is autistic. And he also brings in his family life. He's very open, honest, straightforward, but he's just an extraordinary voice. It's very difficult to believe that it was written by somebody of his age. It really is amazing. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've come across a writer like him before.
I mean, I should say, you know, other small publishers, we shouldn't underestimate the struggles they've had in recent months. I mean, have most of them survived?
I think it's probably too early to know whether they will. I think so far, yes, but I'm sure that this whole thing will take a long time to emerge. And those which maybe have less of a close relationship with their readers and an opportunity to sell books direct will probably struggle. So I think it might be hard. Lots of them are doing interesting and exciting things. There's one publisher called Blue Moose Books who publish literary fiction, and they were the first ever publisher of Ben Myers, and he very generously wrote a little ebook which we put onto our website and split any royalties between us, Blue Moose, and Ben. And so we did that in the very early days of lockdown to try to generate a bit of interest and income. And so I think publishers like Blue Moose will always be inventive and find different ways of doing things.
Absolutely key at the moment is, you know, how well you treat your customers or your subscribers, because a sort of personal relationship really is the way in which you're going to survive.
I think one has a huge advantage in being small because it makes you very flexible, I think. I don't know if you find that, John. You know, we all do all sorts of different things.
I'm sure that's absolutely right. We don't really have job titles at Little Toller. We know roughly the sorts of things that we focus on, we're good at and we enjoy. But of course, we all try to get involved in every bit of the business. And I think that flexibility is, at least in times like this, a huge benefit.
Gail, sorry, you had a point you wanted to make.
Well, no, I was just going to say that an awful lot of small publishers, I think, have been very quick-footed, but I think it must be extremely hard for the larger companies. I mean, as well as delaying publication, we've had to, I think the whole industry's had to wrestle with the fact that one of the major wholesalers in the country is going into administration. And most bookshops use one of two big distributors, and one of them is now in dire straits, basically. It's an indication, isn't it, of what tight margins some companies are operating on.
Both of your companies, you've been extremely agile. And of course, you both invested heavily in your websites, didn't you? So you sell through the website, their beautiful website, interesting places to go. I mean, that work has really borne fruit now, hasn't it?
Yes, yes, it has.
I think it's...
I'm so sorry.
I think that was Gail's doorbell, wasn't
it? Yes. They'll quieten down in a minute.
John.
One of the things about Little Toller is that we've got an extremely strong aesthetic. So quite often we will commission separate prints or illustrations to go alongside our books.
And where do you get your books printed?
So traditionally we've printed our new books in Cornwall. They've done all three print runs of Diary of a Young Naturalist so far, which we've done three in less than a month, which is...
Amazing.
Yeah, it's slightly nerve-jangling, but it's the right thing to do. And they've been absolutely amazing. Reprints, sometimes we print in India because we have less of a time constraint. The quality's really beautiful and we've got a really good relationship with a printer there.
I've been sort of particularly interested because my brother-in-law, Simon Brett, has just done a book with you called The Life and Art of Clifford Webb.
He did, yes.
And that's an incredibly sort of complicated book to put together, it must have been.
Yes, so Simon did an absolutely extraordinary book. It's a book about the artist and engraver Clifford Webb, who died in the early 1970s, had an extraordinary career, but for some reason after his death, possibly because quite a lot of his work was dispersed after his death, has less of a reputation now, and Simon rightly wanted to resurrect his life, make it better known to readers. So he wrote a book which is both a biography and also a thorough examination of the art he produced throughout his life. It was very complicated to put together. It took us a long time to do it, working closely with him.
It really is beautiful, isn't it? And the work of Clifford Webb is just stunning.
It's so intricate as well.
Yes,
it's amazing.
Yes.
I mean, he was an extraordinary engraver, quite difficult to reproduce on the page, actually, wood engravings, but our designer Graham did a spectacular job working with Simon at really bringing them to life, so we're delighted to have published that book.
John, when I started Slightly Foxed, we occupied what had been my children's playroom, and then we very shortly moved into a flat, and Slightly Foxed had a corner there with a couple of desks and a couple of computers and a printer. And we're now at the point in Hoxton Square where certainly in the run-up to Christmas, you know, the bed is literally surrounded by boxes. And I always say, put as much in as you like, as long as we can actually get into bed. Can you paint a picture of what Little Toller's office is like?
Yes, that's familiar to us as well, because Adrian and Gracie began the business from a spare room when they moved to Dorset in 2009. Gracie had grown up there. So they managed somehow in 2009, which is not when I would have advised anyone to start a publishing company.
No, that was all the sorts of
recession,
reasons. Wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ghastly. But because they didn't know that gave them the bravery which has characterised the way they run the business to just continue. It was very much a kitchen table business, which then, as business got larger and more books were published and space ran out, converted an old dairy next door. And it's a beautiful place to work. I do feel that there's something about working in the countryside that gives us a different sort of perspective than you might have from a London publisher. It makes you make different decisions.
Yeah. John, I know that you've reissued The Fat of the Land, and I was thrilled to see it on the Little Toller list because I bought my copy. I've got it sitting by me. It's a Faber paperback. It's got my maiden name in it, August 1977. It was originally published in 1961. I remember when I first read it, this magical account of self-sufficiency, really, by John Seymour. It's such a book of the time. I mean, this is when The Good Life was being shown on the television, and I had fond ideas aged 18 or 19 that I was going to become a smallholder and become completely self-sufficient. It's a lovely book, isn't it?
Yeah, we were delighted to publish it. And you're right, it was a kind of a seminal book. I mean, he was in the 1970s probably slightly better known for his Complete Book of Self-Sufficiency, which was a huge bestseller and did tap into that good life feel. But
he wrote that with his wife, didn't he?
He did, yes, absolutely.
And yes, Sally.
Yes, exactly. It's an extraordinary book. It has ideas of how you might want to blow up a tree stump using just a little bit of dynamite and things, which probably would not make its way into a book these days. But The Fat of the Land was his earlier book and his autobiography. Remarkably honest, and he talks about all the mistakes he made when trying to become self-sufficient, how he worked with a family. And what we tried to do with our edition of the book was to try to incorporate that family feel by using some of Sally's original illustrations throughout the book.
I reread it not that long ago, and I think he must have been rather an impossible man to live with.
I'm sure he was.
You know, to start farming, he first of all started, didn't he, in East Anglia, and then he moved to Wales.
Yeah, to Pembrokeshire, yeah.
Gosh, you know, a tough life.
I think so. I mean, he's quite honest in the book about making any living he makes from writing and that it would be difficult to live an entirely self-sufficient life. But as Hugh Ferning Whittingstall, who introduced our edition, points out, it kind of gives a beacon of hope to those of us who are slightly dissatisfied with what modern life has to offer and might want something a bit simpler.
That was one of those books, wasn't it, that kind of summed up a kind of inciting moment in history. It was just that moment when globalisation and industrialised farming and food production, it was all about to explode technologically. And people like him were putting their hands up and saying, you know, this may not be the way forward. I was thinking about this because I haven't read that book. I'm aware of it. But I was thinking about it and I was thinking of climate change and the issues we're talking about now. It's another moment like that, isn't it, right now? And there's some interesting books coming out of that. Because I saw you published something called Landfill, didn't you, by Tim Dee, which is about waste. And it struck me that, you know, it's the same sort of vein, isn't it? Key issues that we haven't quite got our arms around right now.
I think that's right. You asked me a question earlier about, you know, what defines a Little Toller book, and Tim Dee's Landfill, which is about, well, it's about gulls and gulling and about waste. And of course, they've occupied the same space as we do. And maybe that's one of the reasons that humans sometimes aren't very keen on gulls. They make the most of our waste. So Tim's marvellous book explains that in some detail, and he spends a lot of time on rubbish dumps, so not a traditionally beautiful rural background at all.
But he's drawing wider conclusions, isn't he?
Well, he absolutely is, about globalisation and the way that humans live and about the way we might want to choose to live with wildlife.
I mean, would it be fair to say that small publishers like you have been, you know, a lot quicker to publish interesting books in that sort of arena than the big opposition?
I hope so. I think that maybe what we have as an advantage is that we can be fleet of foot. We don't, of course, answer to armies of shareholders.
So or giant marketing teams.
Indeed. And sometimes those giant marketing teams, I mean, I feel for them a little bit because they have so many books to market. Whereas while we have absolutely no money to do anything like that, we instead can offer a little bit more dedication and a kind of a real response to the text. Whether we're always successful is a different one.
Of course, that resonates, doesn't it, Hazel? I mean, yes. We have an editorial committee of two. Yeah. And, you know, we've certainly taken some risks on things. And, I mean, I remember we published a little book called Mr. Tibbet's School, which is all about a rather eccentric small prep school in South Kensington. And when it arrived, it made us laugh so much that we decided to publish it. And I don't think another publisher, or certainly a big publisher, wouldn't have touched it in a million years. But you can follow your own passions. You don't have to follow fashion.
And no focus groups on what people will actually buy.
Oh, no. Yes. No, not at all. Well, our subscribers are our focus group, really.
I mean, we must move on. But I did want to ask both, actually all of you, really. We talked a lot about the difficulties of, you know, the recent months and our experiences of lockdown and emerging from lockdown, but are there things that have emerged out of this that you will continue to do and have been useful experiences?
I don't know about you, John, but I mean, quite apart from the fact that an awful lot of people have been sending us articles, which have clearly been sitting in a bottom drawer for a while, we've had time to sit back and reflect and think about what we're going to do in the future. And that's been a real luxury, because normally you're so busy, but the last few months have certainly enabled us to give more thought to the future and how the business is going to develop.
I think that's exactly right. And thinking about how one might try to make everything a little bit more robust as well, because I actually haven't seen Adrian or Gracie or Graham for months. But I do think that, the opportunity to work from home a little bit more, to have broader horizons, and actually by working from home, maybe jumping in our cars a bit less.
Yes, and I think the sort of need to keep in touch. Gail and I have started doing a weekly diary for readers, and people do enjoy it.
I really enjoy them. I've enjoyed every single one of them, and particularly because, of course, one of you is writing from London and one of you from Devon, and to see that contrast. And I notice more about dogs versus cats.
Oh, yes, a running theme for the podcast.
Indeed, I think so, yeah. Get some cats in there.
I mean, just to wrap up what we say about new ways of working, it's probably worth saying learning how to do what we're doing right now, getting the technology working so we can record the podcast wherever people are, that's been a fascinating experience, I think, for all of us. Well, it's been some technological challenges, but it's rather delightful to be able to do it, isn't it?
I think in a way, when you're doing it separately, you're sort of listening perhaps more carefully because you haven't got any other clues.
Yes.
And I do think that is a kind of plus.
Yes, although poor Hazel's been a bit stressed by the technology, I think. She's braced up wonderfully.
Yes. But thank you, John. Really such an interesting insight into Little Toller. Stay with us. We are keen to hear which book you're going to recommend to us. And talking of titles, you'll find every single book we mentioned today in the show notes attached to this episode. And all that information is on the Slightly Fox website too. That's foxquarterly.com. We're going to move on now to an extract from an archive issue of the Slightly Fox magazine, which has been specially recorded for the podcast. Now, if you're one of Fox's many recent subscribers, you'll now know what a box of delights the quarterly magazine always is. If not, this will give you a taste of the pieces you're missing out on, all written by someone with deep knowledge and a real passion for one particular book. So, Hazel, tell us, this is indeed about a book we've just been discussing, isn't it?
Yes, in fact, it's about two books, really. It's about John Seymour's The Fat of the Land and also his book on self-sufficiency, written by Rowena MacDonald. And her parents actually had a go at self-sufficiency during the first 6 years of her life on the Isle of Wight, so she's got a sort of personal affection and connection for these books.
I live in East London, in a second-floor flat with no garden. My groceries come from the local corner shop, and when I feel strong enough to face it, from the hellhole that is Sainsbury's in Whitechapel. I grow some herbs in pots on my windowsill. The sage and rosemary do quite well, but the coriander, tarragon, mint and parsley remain spindly however much I coax them. I have been known to forage for elderflowers, nettles and blackberries in Victoria Park, and once, while visiting Dungeness, I broke off some sea kale from the shingle to eat with the kippers I'd bought, then quickly had to hide it on realising that it was a plant from an area of special scientific interest. In short, I am not in the least self-sufficient. And yet two books that have always had a strong influence on my imagination are the Back to the Land classics by John Seymour, The Fat of the Land and Self-Sufficiency. My copies are the original editions, published by Faber, with beautiful woodcut illustrations by the author's wife, Sally Seymour, and diagrams of things that I will probably never need to know if I carry on living as I do, such as how to prune a fruit tree, how to dig a drainage trench in a field, and the monk device for controlling water level in fish ponds. Seymour never explains what this device has to do with monks, and admits, "I've never done fish farming, but simply write so much about it in the possibility that it will arouse interest in someone with more energy than I have." However, Seymour did do practically everything else that he wrote about in these two books, and in doing so, he aroused the interest of a swathe of people in the late 60s and early 70s who wanted to turn their back on the soulless commercialism of the modern world and seek out the good life. Two of those people were my parents. They married in 1973, and I was born in 1974. For the first few years of my life, we lived in a small cottage on the Isle of Wight. My parents kept goats, two of them, named Bella and Katie, and also bees, and they had a vegetable patch. By the time I was six, we had moved to Stourbridge in the West Midlands. There, my dad built me a treehouse, and for years I kept the two John Seymour books in it and pondered over them. In retrospect, it seems an odd thing for a child to do. I didn't really read them, just looked at their pictures and imbibed their vibe. I like the idea that if I wasn't living in the midst of the West Midlands conurbation, if I wasn't just a kid and had access to fields of cows and barley, I could follow John Seymour's instructions and make myself some cheese and beer. John Seymour was an extraordinarily energetic and, reading between the lines of his obituaries, exhausting character. He was born in 1914 and died in 2004, crammed several careers, three wives and six children into his 90 years, and wrote 41 books. In 1954, he married his first wife, Sally Medworth, an Australian potter. For a while, they lived on a Dutch sailing smack, but eventually, finding this impractical for family life, they rented two small adjoining cottages on 5 acres of land near Orford in Suffolk, and fell into self-sufficiency. The Fat of the Land describes the process of how they built up their cottage economy, starting with a cow, then pigs, then a horse to plough their land and pull them in a cart around the countryside, until they produced everything they needed to live, except salt, sugar, flour, tea and coffee. And, as Seymour writes on the first page, "We could, and probably soon will anyway, produce our own flour. Honey could, and if I can overcome my natural repugnance to the inhabitants of the two beehives, soon will take the place of sugar. Salt we could get by evaporating seawater on a nearby beach over a driftwood fire. Tea and coffee we could no doubt learn to do without." Self-sufficiency, subtitled The Science and Art of Producing and Preserving Your Own Food, is more of a manual and less of a narrative than The Fat of the Land, and was written 12 years later. It is, however, no less absorbing. Seymour tells you in a straightforward, casual way exactly how and when to breed cows. A cow shows that she's bulling by mounting other cows in a lesbian fashion. How to slaughter said cow, or pig, or chicken. How to cure bacon. How to malt barley and brew it into beer. How to make different kinds of cheese. What kind of wood is best for smoking fish. And 100 other fascinating things besides. Along the way, you learn the meaning of all sorts of obscure words, such as cheddaring, sparging, and gaffing. And even if you know you'll never have the time, the opportunity, or even the inclination to do any of these things, it is wonderfully reviving to be plunged into this wholesome world.
Gosh, that reminds me, when we kept chickens as students, I decided one day that it was time to kill one. It wasn't laying any eggs. And I can remember standing by the kitchen door with a book open and reading out instructions to my husband. I won't tell you what happened, but it was all rather gory.
That's but reminds me of With Nail and I. You know that comes, you know the film?
Yes.
How do I make it die?
Exactly, how do I make it die?
I must go back to self-sufficiency, and we no longer have chickens, but I'd forgotten how much detail is in there.
It's a really wonderful book, isn't it? It's fantastic. Mm. That piece just really captures the flavour of Seymour. His prose style is remarkable, that combination of being extremely straightforward with really evocative. It's quite unique.
I just have to point out, it did just come after Schumacher's book, didn't it? Small is Beautiful, because it has the most lovely, lovely subtitle, I think, of any book I've ever read about economics, and I have read quite a few, A Study of Economics, As If People Mattered.
Mm.
And that was the whole vibe, wasn't it, about all these books at that time. That was an extract from Rowena MacDonald's piece on John Seymour's The Fat of the Land. And thanks to the actor Martin Hyder for reading it for us. Book recommendations from everyone in a moment. First, a word about Slightly Foxed. elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Okay, recommendations from everyone, please. I'm going to start with Gail.
Well, I've got a collection of short stories by a man called Wendell Berry, titled Stand By Me. Wendell Berry has been writing novels and poetry and for over 40 years, and he's another man ahead of his time. In 1977, he wrote a book called The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture, in which he argued against industrial agriculture and in favour of small-scale, locally-based farming, what we would now call sustainable agriculture. He's now in his mid-80s, and he still lives on a farm in Kentucky, where he grew up. And he uses traditional methods to farm the land there. And he speaks very eloquently in all his writing about the importance of local communities and of caring for the land. I first came across him from a contributor of ours called Richard Platt, who lives on the west coast of America. Dear Richard, every time he wants to write an article about a book, he always sends me a first edition of it.
How lovely.
The book he sent me was called Jaber Crow, The Life Story of Jaber Crow, Barber of the Port William Membership, as written by himself. And it's a glorious book about a man who grows up in Port William, which is Port Royal in real life. He goes away, but he does come back and he ends up as the town's barber. And for the next 30 years, he cuts hair and talks to all the members of the community. And he philosophizes and muses on love and hate, marital discord, all the things that happen to people in a small community. So that's a wonderful book and I would recommend it. But from it has come these collection of short stories, and there are about 16 of them, and they start in the 1880s and they finish in the 1970s. And each one is narrated by a different character in the same community. There's a lovely little story about an enormously tall farmer called Ptolemy Proudfoot, and he has a passion for Miss Minnie, who's a diminutive schoolmistress. It's very touching how he asks her out. Another story about a woman who rescues a man from a drunken mob who are out to lynch him. Someone else who comes back from the Second World War and reflecting on what he's been through and the community that he's going to rejoin. They really are magical stories, and I find it very hard to encapsulate, you know, just how rich they are in perception about the, you know, the way in which we behave and the way life has its twists and turns.
John.
So I've chosen a writer who is one of the very few writers I've read almost every word he's written in book form, and that's Graham Swift's latest book, Here We Are. Obviously, he's best known for winning the Booker Prize for Last Orders and probably for his much earlier novel, Waterland, which for me was a really important book because I was I was a student of history, but I'd spent many years, I suppose, reading the kind of great 19th century classics. And so when a friend of mine gave me Waterland, I suppose it was the first time a contemporary novel really had that huge punch. But in his later career, Swift has focused on really small lives of usually people who are not well known. They might just be working class characters who are wrestling with something from their past and trying to find some sort of resolution within it. And he writes very simply. There's very little metaphor in his books, I've noticed. And in a way, they're almost like ever-decreasing circles. So each book focuses on one tiny thing a little bit more than the previous one does. And Here We Are is a book about three characters working the summer season in Brighton at the end of the pier in the 1950s. One magician, his assistant, and the compere of the show. one thing happens right towards the end of the book, which has an enormous impact on their lives in the ensuing decades. I think he's absolutely an extraordinary writer. He always gets respectful reviews, but I do sort of feel he's maybe less fashionable than some of his contemporaries who came to prominence at the same time, people like Julian Barnes or Ishiguro.
Yes.
And yet I think he's a really important writer. Yeah, I urge people to read more of Swift.
Hazel.
Perhaps like a lot of people, I've been trying during lockdown to read some of the things which are actually on our shelves. And I'm reading a book of Chekhov's short stories at the moment. I've been better acquainted, really, with his plays. And they are a revelation, really. The way he gets inside people's heads, even when they're not very likeable people, he has a kind of tender approach to them. His stories are just, they don't have a beginning, they don't have an end, really. They're just a little slice of life. And you can imagine perhaps what went on before this story happened, what might happen afterwards. You know, he will take a sort of, just a moment. At one point he writes a schoolboy who's travelling with his grandfather, and they stop to meet someone that his grandfather has some business to do with, and it's hot, and they stop at this fly-blown place where they meet this Armenian. They're all exhausted and everything seems depressing. Then the Armenian calls in his little daughter, who's about 16. It's called The Beauties, this story, and she's just sort of so beautiful. Everything about her, he notices, the way her little bare feet show underneath these big Turkish pants that she's wearing. And she has this lovely classical profile. And yet she's in the middle of this sort of crude, rather awful outpost. And, you know, he has a sort of mixed feeling of kind of melancholy and longing and sadness. And that's just the end of the story. They leave, but the memory obviously stays with them all because the coachman says, "She was a beauty, wasn't she?" or something like that. I just find them so moving and sort of tender. It's a picture of Russian life at the time.
As you said, they're intensely vivid, aren't they? Fleeting, but
so vivid, yes, absolutely fleeting, yes. He does evoke the setting as well beautifully, you know, the hay fields, the smell of them, and they're a revelation to me.
Yeah, because we've all had these moments in our life, haven't we?
Yes.
It takes you right there.
Smell of it's in your nose, isn't it?
Yes.
But that's
yes.
The writing. Mm.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, that is it for this month. Thanks so much, John, for being with us. We've really enjoyed having you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Visit the Slightly Fox website to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine, or just browse through the books you'll find on sale there. Foxquarterly.com is the web address. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do review and rate us, whichever app you use to listen. The more ratings we get, the more listeners we reach, which is what we like. We'll be back on the 15th of September. And thank you, as always, for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition off the beaten track.